Good morning. It's live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short. Typically, we also have Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell here on Okanagan Country Radio. Unfortunately, the representatives aren't able to join us this morning. They have some other things on their schedule. So just have Senator Short with us today. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. If you have any questions, feel free to email me directly. It's tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's T-R-A-C-Y dot E-L-L-I-S at leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100. 509-826-0100. As we often do on this program, Senator Short, we're going to start by talking about wolves today. And Representative Engel isn't here to talk about his wolf bill, but you will. Some unfortunate news, actually, with that bill.
Well, there really is some unfortunate news, and I just want to say hello to everyone back home. So Andrew's bill would have downlisted the wolves from endangered to sensitive. He felt really good about that, was getting really good feedback from the Democrats on the committee. And when he got to committee that day, they said, well, if we're voting your bill, you have to vote for another one. And the other one was actually to repeal essentially protections for Okanagan County as it related to grizzly bear reintroduction. Senator Morton, you know, worked so hard for several years to really get, you know, Okanagan County to be listened to, you know, by the state. And the bill that Andrew would have had to have voted for was essentially a bill to do away with those protections. And Andrew texted me and he said he was so disappointed, but there was no way that he was going to, you know, vote for that bill. And so neither bill passed out of committee. And I just want to let folks know that happens a lot over here. You know, they want to see if you can be bought. And you really have to really create a line in the sand, if you will, about how you're going to handle those situations. And I can tell you, I'm so proud of Andrew. It was really hard. We work really hard on the issues, you know, to give voice to our local constituents, especially on this wolf management issue. But I'm just really proud that he didn't cave to that. And I just wanted listeners to know that.
Yeah, I guess let's just to recap. So basically what happened here is he gets in the committee. So Friday was what we call it was cut off for policy bills. That means if bills don't get out of committee by that point, and there are some exceptions, but for the most part, that means they die. And yep. So this wolf bill that Representative Engel had bipartisan support, actually unanimous bipartisan support at one point, and it was about to be voted out of committee and moved on to the House floor. And the chair of the committee said, we're not doing that. This is one person, the chair of this committee, said, we're not doing that unless you vote for a bill that reintroduces grizzly bears to your district that already has this wolf issue. Now you would have grizzly bears. And Representative Engel said, no, I can't vote for that bill. She said, well, sorry, then your wolf bill is dead.
Right. So the issue here, and I don't know, frankly, who made that ultimate decision to tie the two together. But the one thing I was reminded about when I looked at the bill is the only thing it would have prevented is the state from reintroducing. You know, the advocates on the other side claimed that Senator Morton's bill prevented the state from even, like, being involved in coordination with the federal government and others. The biggest thing the bill did was to prevent the state from reintroducing grizzly bears. So there's a bit of misinformation there. But again, I'm just, unfortunately, we're in the minority. You know, we work really hard to be given opportunities to advance things, but oftentimes they do get tied to other things. And folks, I've killed my own bills before because I'm just not going to allow them to be taken hostage.
Speaking of killing bills, you managed to do that with the wood stove bill.
I did. So reminding listeners, this bill would have essentially, when it was initially introduced, would have created double regulation. The Environmental Protection Agency at the federal level already regulates the emissions. This bill, as it was proposed, would have created state emissions and would have also given ecology rulemaking authority to decide which wood stoves would or would not be sold in the state of Washington. Our manufacturers were caught right in the middle. Folks, you and I and everyone else in our district was caught in the middle because we use wood stoves and pellet stoves to heat our homes. And so throughout the committee time period and all of the things that go on, we were trying to get it down to just adopting the federal standard, which everybody was good with, manufacturers. It would have kept, you know, options open for consumers. And ecology finally pulled the plug and said, no, we're not going to do that. I think there's an opportunity to work with manufacturers to engage them and better understand their testing process, you know, how they get stoves to, you know, comply with the federal government's emission standards. So I see an opportunity. And to be quite frank, the new ecology director really seems open to that. So I was super happy that that bill is not going to move forward. Folks, this is an issue I've been fighting against my entire time in the legislature.
Are there other bills that you could think of off the top of your head that died, bad bills that you were opposed to?
Well, stay tuned. There are a lot of moving pieces as we move through the legislative session. You know, sometimes, kind of like what Andrew, he felt his bill was in a really good place, and then all of a sudden it wasn't. So the only other issue I've been super pleased with is the governor calling back those Fish and Wildlife Commission appointments. I think that was a huge victory. To allow him time to decide how his new administration is going to handle the commission and do appointments. But there are a couple of bills I wanted to highlight that unfortunately are still well alive. And one has been dubbed the initiative killer bill. I heard that in state government committee. And essentially, it would create onerous standards on signature gatherers as well as significant penalties. Actually, it creates a process that is more stringent than what we do as voters when we vote in elections. I'm like, okay, that makes no sense. They're requiring more on signature gatherers than they are on our election process. So unfortunately, that bill is still alive and well. We offered amendments to really narrow the bill's focus and really talk about the importance of the people's right to initiative, the people's voice when it comes to displeasure with how their legislature is handling issues. But unfortunately, that bill is still well alive. So we're going to do everything we can to continue to fight against it.
On that bill, before we move on, some people, and this was featured in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, this bill, say that this really is just a thinly veiled effort by Democrats to make it more difficult to get initiatives on the ballot. It has nothing to do with fraud, which is what they're claiming. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they're 100% right. If you look at the state of Oregon, who did something similar many years ago, the number of initiatives they've been able to get qualified is just very few. It is absolutely designed to make it not doable. It's just stunning to me when you think about, here we have the majority doing their work. The people of the state of Washington, actually pretty significant number of them, like, you know, close to 450,000 just last year received signatures, you know, were able to gather signatures on a number of initiatives, including the natural gas ban, too. And it just shows that, you know, their voice was heard above all others in a legislature that consistently drowns out, you know, you can call it the opposition, or you can just call it, you know, folks who have a difference of opinion about how their government ought to work. And it's just it is offensive, frankly, and it's appalling. And I'm hoping that this bill at some point does not make it through the process, but I'm really worried about this one.
Do you see this as a pattern from legislative Democrats? Are they trying to drown out dissent? I mean, we saw in the House a rule that's been in place for 100 years that allowed allowed basically debate to continue on a bill unless two-thirds of the majority said no. They changed that to just make it a simple majority. So now basically Republican voices, I mean, Republicans believe they're being stifled there. This is another instance. I mean, do you see this as a pattern?
Well, I do. And it's really unfortunate because what it does is it drowns out the good work that we do in a bipartisan nature. And I can tell you that in the Senate, there's very few instances where we feel our voices are not heard or not given a chance to be heard. And honestly, when I say our voices, it's your voices. It's the voice of people who have a difference of opinion, who really have a different way of looking at an issue. And I think the unfortunate part of this is there's not been divided government in quite a while in the state of Washington. We had it for a few years in the Senate with the majority coalition caucus, and then Senate Republicans for a short time did have outright majority by one, which is not much. And we came close in the House when I was in the House, and it was like 50-48. So the unfortunate nature there is it doesn't lend itself to creative solutions, to working together, to give and take, and maybe taking the more onerous bills, the more way out there bills, you know, off the table, if you will. So it is unfortunate, but I've got to say that, you know, I'm proud of the bipartisan efforts that I do see, and they are ongoing. And there's some in the House too. It's just this is the kind of thing that continues to drown out the hard work that we do. And I do think that the majority in Olympia, the majority Democrats, aren't listening. They're not listening.
Another example of that may be the emergency powers reform bill, right? This is a bill that it's very interesting that the Republican sponsor, Senator Keith Wagoner, negotiated with the Democrat governor, Bob Ferguson. They came up with a solution to reform emergency powers, the governor's emergency powers. And you know, how about that? The governor actually working to reform his own powers. They come up with something, and then Senate Democrats say, no, that's not going to work. And they came up with something totally different. Talk a little bit about where that bill is and what happened.
Well, this has been an issue that was a surprise to everyone. When Governor Ferguson gave his initial state of the state, if you will, when he was sworn in, he called this issue out and said that he wanted to work with Republicans, that there were changes that were needed when it came to, you know, the power of the governor. And so we, of course, you know, jumped on that right away as an opportunity to offer a balanced legislation that was introduced by Senator Linda Wilson. She's no longer here in the legislature, but just a thoughtful process of how we do this work when there is an emergency, and that the legislature should have a balanced role as well, which we know in the previous administration was not the case. And so the bill was put forward. We had really good hearing. Well, and the bill was scheduled to be voted out of committee by committee deadline this last Friday. Well, the chair offered his own substitute bill, his own version, and that version was worse than current law. Folks, just let that sink in. That his version minimized legislative involvement, made it worse. I didn't think there was a worse way to do that when we all were under the COVID rule of the previous governor. and yet his did. So we had dueling, versions, if you will. And unfortunately, no surprise, but theirs survived and was voted out of committee over our objections. They did say that they can consider it what we call here is a work in progress, meaning there's more work to be done. But the further a bill gets along, it's awfully hard to do that. I mean, obviously, we will continue to fight for fairness and fight for, you know, the legislature to have better representation at the table when it comes to emergency powers. Now, just one last thing on that. There are those that say, oh, my gosh, there that would be chaos. Folks, we actually early on in it, when we were dealing with COVID, we came to agreement on things. It wasn't until, and by the way, we did that for the betterment of folks in the state of Washington and their, you know, and potential impact to health. But then Inslee started taking it upon himself as a ruler of one, if you will, and it went a much different path. So I believe and am confident that the legislature and the governor could work together for the betterment of the citizens of Washington State, Washingtonians, and do the work we need to do. Those are hard items. They're hard decisions. They're hard discussions, but that's frankly what we're sent here to do. So stay tuned. I'm hoping that we can get the bill back, but the Governor Ferguson sent a letter to the committee saying that he supported Senator Wagner's version. And so this is quite an interesting development.
Could it be a situation, and this happens oftentimes too, that when the majority party wants a bill to be their bill and not a Republican bill, is there a chance that, you know, this bill gets back to exactly where it was and it's just now a Democrat bill and no longer Senator Wagner's bill? Not that that means any less of an impact, but sometimes that sort of thing goes on too here at Olympia.
Oh, sure, it does. The thing is, it's Senator Wagner's the prime sponsor.
Yeah, right.
So
no matter what, it's his
so
bill.
So no
right.
matter what, it's his bill. But folks, what we've continually said and it is you shouldn't care who gets the credit. You want to get the policy or the issue across the finish line.
It is. Just so people know, that is part of what happens in Olympia sometimes, though. It's the Democrats want it to be their bill, so, you know, their version gets across the finish line instead of the Republican version. Again, not that anybody back home really cares about it. They just want the bill to be, you know, they just want the law to be changed. If you have a question, you can email me. It's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, or you can call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. You have an issue that you wanted to talk about regarding a library situation in your district. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and maybe explain to people, it's a complex issue and, you know, this is an opportunity for you to explain to people exactly where you're coming from and why.
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity to do this. For listeners, there has been a proposal to expand the Republic Library, create a community center and a child care center, all three of which, you know, quite frankly, are needed. And there's been, you know, local group of folks that have been really helping that project, you know, raising money, raising awareness. And they came to me when Jacqueline left the legislature, you know, they came to me and said, would you continue to support this project? And I told them I would. So we were, you know, getting and by the way, when I say support the project, you know, our state capital budget, there are member project requests that come in and then a project can be submitted for consideration. I just want folks to be clear, you know, my, you know, putting in a request does not guarantee that it gets funded. But, you know, we work really hard.
And we should make clear also that when you say Jacqueline, that's Representative Maycomber.
Yeah, sorry about that. Everybody knows Jacqueline, and that's a good thing. But she worked really hard, and, you know, I said I would continue that effort. So we're, you know, come here for legislative session, and I start hearing from folks concerned that the pride flag continues to, you know, continues to be displayed in the interior of the library, even though, you know, Pride Month, which is June, which, you know, pride flags are put up in recognition, and that flag continued to be flown and really felt like that wasn't carrying through the mission of the library, which is to be a space for everyone. And so I just started with talking to local folks, talking to the executive director of the library, the folks that are raising money, talked with just a lot of local people to really kind of gauge what was going on with the issue. Found out that was in case the issue, and that people were feeling uncomfortable with being able to use the library. And I thought, well, I started when I talked to the executive director, I just thought, okay, is there something you can do to change this? Does the flag need to be continued to be flown? You know, you're asking for a lot of money from the state, and just really trying to help, you know, deal with the situation and bring it to a successful conclusion, which would be, you know, offering the project to be funded, what they were asking for at that point, not the entire construction, but their planning. And just really have to say, I'm disappointed. This is when I talked to the executive director and the board was going to be offering up a resolution, if you will, kind of a display resolution. When I pressed for more information, they said, well, it's guidance. And I said, well, does the librarian have to follow guidance? And they essentially said, no, they have tremendous autonomy to, you know, to decide what's shown on the interior of the library. And I felt so incredibly disappointed in that. And said I in good conscience couldn't continue with supporting funding in the capital budget. And so I declined to submit their application for consideration. And I have heard from a lot of folks on this. I consider that public spaces should be neutral. And when I think of the important role that libraries have, you know, to offer books and services and kind of be a safety net for families that don't have access to the things that they do, that mission is a critical mission. But I come back to, you know, are we going to allow, you know, certain group to have more consideration than others? And when I think of free speech, folks, that's free speech. That First Amendment is for everyone. Are you going to start putting up different flags, or are you going to put up the cross? You know, are you going to put up things that are going to be reflective of other parts of the community? And that answer would be no. That would be rather chaotic. So I just feel like you shouldn't be doing it for one particular group. Now, folks would say that, you know, we want to create a safe space for kids that are bullied and are trying to figure out who they are and all of that. And my answer to that is there are many ways that we can support our kids that are going through, you know, chaotic times and questioning who they are and all of that. A flag doesn't need to represent that. There are many ways to do that and still offer, you know, offer a shoulder to lean on, offer an ear when kids are having a hard time. But I also feel that library is in a community that there are a lot of folks that are nervous to stand up. And frankly, you know, I'm speaking for them. It's not me. It's not my own values or what I believe I would want done. And it's not even for the people who have spoken up, which everyone knows. It's really for people who are watching this going, well, I don't agree with this, but I'm afraid to speak up, or I know what happens when you speak up. And so I just really wanted time this morning to just share. I've never had to pull back support on a project, and I was so hoping the library board would have taken a different position, and was really hoping they would do that. You know, I have responsibility and I realize that, but so do they. So does the librarian. So does the library board. And I really feel we need to get back our library system to be places where everyone feels welcome and has an opportunity to use the great services that our libraries provide. And I'm really sad about it, to be honest, but just wanted, you know, folks to know in greater detail. People are putting words in my mouth about, you know, why I wanted to do this. And I just wanted to be upfront with folks.
This is Live from Olympia, and that was 7th District State Senator Shelley Short. I'm Trace Yellis with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. You can email me with your questions, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. And we're going to take a quick break and be right back to Olympia. Welcome back to Live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short. Typically, Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell are here as well, but they have other things on their schedule today. So just Senator Short with us on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm your host, Trace Yellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. Email me with your questions, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. We were talking about bills that died, but a lot of bills still alive, and bills that you like and bills that you don't like, Senator Short. And one that is on the don't like list is the road usage charge. Talk a little bit about that, where that is, what it is, and why you oppose it.
Well, first of all, the bill in the House and Senate were each heard in the transportation committees. And we've talked a lot about committee deadlines being last Friday, but for issues involving the budget, or finance, transportation, budget committees, there are no deadlines until session is over and done. And so the road usage charge bill is still alive and well, unfortunately. And what that actually amounts to is double taxation. And the way it works, you continue to pay gas tax because that gas tax can't be done away with until the bonds are paid off. Well, the road usage charge would be up on top of that, and then they have another amount of money that's on top of that. It's just pretty stunning for those of us who live in rural communities, live, you know, a great distance from even the grocery store or gas station, you name it, and it's just. I get quiet because it's daunting to me that they're doing this when they see how families are struggling. And they've been wanting to put this into place for a while. And our transportation projects, our infrastructure is really, really important, but there are other ways to provide funding for that while we're using the gas tax to pay off previous projects. And this, they'll tell you, well, you get a reduction, you know, in the amount. So the gas tax you pay gets reduced against your road usage charge. But the state readily admits that they haven't figured out how they're going to do that. I think our farmers and ranchers know all too well how that works because they've been paying tax they weren't supposed to be paying from the Climate Commitment Act in the form of higher gas prices. So it's to be said how they're going to do all of that. But if that isn't a system that's set up right now, I don't believe that folks will have that benefit of that reduction. So it is, in fact, double taxation. And the clincher, it's more costly to collect. So there's actually going to be less of it going to transportation than what we have with the current gas tax, which is very simple to collect. There are issues of privacy as well. In terms of how you're going to decide how many miles somebody has driven. So it's a bad idea. We have put forward bills that would actually take the sales tax from the sale of vehicles and actually put that to transportation. That's a novel idea. And frankly, phase it in so to lessen the impact on the state budget revenues. So there are ideas out there. It's just they really, really, really want this. And I really, really don't. So this is going to be something we're going to be fighting all session, unfortunately. I hope it doesn't come up, but I'm worried it may.
Yeah, that's a charge by mile type situation. Like you said, trying to figure out how many miles a person drove is one issue. But there are people in your district in Eastern Washington who have driveways that are 6, 7, 10 miles long driveways. So they're paying a fair amount just to go get the mail.
Well, and those things aren't supposed to factor in. But again, how do you do that? We're supposed to. It's supposed to be county and state roads. Well, I don't know. It's just a nightmare. I think it just shows how bad of an idea it is.
And part of the reason they want to do this is because there are some cars now that don't pay the gas tax, right? I mean, electric vehicles don't pay a gas tax. Hybrid vehicles pay a gas tax, but they don't use as much gas. So the revenues from the gas tax are being impacted by that. But you mentioned this briefly. I think it's worth talking about a little bit more that there are other ways that you could get at this, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, for example, using sales tax on motor vehicle sales. Mm-hmm. I've heard people suggest, auto parts, using sales tax on, auto parts. I've heard some people talk about tires as a way to get after it. I mean, there are other options out there that beyond just this mileage tax.
There right? absolutely are.
Speaking of taxes, and we're speaking a lot of them this legislative session, Democrats have several tax proposals that seem alive and well this session. Talk about some of those and, why this concerns you.
Well, first, I just think as an overarching thing, the last few years, there's been incredibly poor planning on the part of the majority Democrats in Olympia there were warning signs that revenue was still good, but our spending was outpacing that revenue. And so, surprise, that's where we're at right now. And
maybe I should recap the situation. Here's the situation. The Democrats say that we have a budget shortfall of up to around, we've heard as much as 12 million.
A billion,
yes. 12 million would be delightful. 12 billion. But, just so people understand, the tax revenues, the money coming into the state is actually, record revenue. So there's more money coming into the state than ever before, but yet there's still this up to $12 billion budget shortfall. And to make up for that, Democrats are talking about raising taxes. That's where we are.
We are there, absolutely. They continue to spend. And one of the things that they did— Look, there are a lot of important issues and things where the state can provide assistance. Now, whether or not they should is another question. But they put off a lot of their spending in out years. So bills that were passed back in, say 2021, 2022 is coming due, folks. And they can be the best ideas. And you still got to be able to pay for them. And I think the worst thing to do is when we set expectations that a program's going to increase, or whether that's for child care centers or, education, and then the state can't follow through. And that's just leads to, the expectations of that are really hard. And that's where we're at. So what are they going to do about it? We're not exactly sure. I do know that the budget's being looked at, and I do think there will be cuts to some degree, but there are a number of proposals I just wanted to, highlight really quick, and we don't know which ones are going to go through, if any, but I do think there will be some. The majority Democrats have been very vocal and outspoken to say that we need to raise taxes. Wealth tax is one that could raise $13 billion over 4 years. payroll or jumpstart tax. That's on a payroll tax on those that make higher incomes. Up to $8 billion could be brought in over 4 years. And then there's the B&O surcharge, which would be $6 billion. That B&O surcharge, by the way, is on our small businesses. They already pay B&O tax, and there would be a surcharge on the taxes they currently pay. And to put that into context, the capital gains tax is a very volatile tax, and the amount of money it's brought in is a lot less than they expected. We've also had really wealthy people move out of the state of Washington. When they do that, they no longer pay tax to Washington. And so I think there's just a number of concerns about, number one, those taxes. I don't care who's taxed. At some point, you and I are going to pay for that.
Well, yeah, with the business and occupation tax, especially, well, right, businesses are going to have to pass that along, right?
Well, exactly. And so it's really... We need to make the hard decisions, and they are hard decisions, and people have relied on those state funds. But we need to have that conversation, and we need to do the right thing, and we need to right-size the state's budget to meet where the revenue's at. But some other taxes that are up for consideration, obviously, you know, there are folks on both sides of simple majority for the K-12 bonds. I get that. I have yet to see how that protects property taxpayer. That's a big concern for me, but those bills are still under consideration. There'd be a state property tax for rental properties and business properties and a homestead exemption, but with a tax shift. That means everybody else pays for that. Now, we had bills last year on homestead exemptions that did not create a tax shift.
So that's unfortunate. What does that mean, homestead exemption?
Well, it essentially says that you get a certain value on your primary residence. Okay. So you could, let's just say you had, you know, $400,000 value that you were paying property taxes on that value. You know, you'd get the homestead exemption was, I think, for $250,000. So you would basically be exempt and your taxes would be based on the $150,000. Okay. But it was done without a tax shift. This particular bill creates a tax shift, which means everybody else is going to be paying for that value. That's not the right way to do it. Day use fees increase state parks, hunting and fishing license fee increases. Cell phone tax rate increases. There's just, tripling the growth of the state property tax. That would allow counties to be able to raise their tax growth rate from 1% to 3%. By the way, they can do that right now. They just have to take it to a vote of the people.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, I think, because right now counties and cities can raise taxes every year by 1% without having to ask for a vote of the people. But if they want to go beyond 1%, all they have to do is ask the voters. So the idea here is that if there's something in your community, like if you could see that, hey, we need more money for police, or we need more money for roads. It's like, okay, you know, I think most citizens will say if it's to a dire enough situation, we'll let you raise taxes. Otherwise, we don't want to do that. Well, they're talking about allowing cities and counties to raise that 3% every year automatically without now the city councils and county commissions would have to vote on that, but still without a vote of the people. So all of a sudden now it goes from 1% to 3%, and counties and cities are going to do that.
Well, and here's the other thing that goes along with that. Local governments are considered an arm of the state. And unfortunately, what the state has done, they've put a lot of mandates on our local government that the state refuses to fund. I think if you look at indigent defense, that is one of the biggest cost drivers. And look, folks, they have an absolute right to to representation. So I'm not talking about the issue, but what I'm talking about is the state should fund it. Right now, I think the state funds like 5% of the cost. That is a huge, huge cost driver in our local communities and our counties, that they end up funding that. And it's only getting worse. So there are a number of things that the state foists upon, you know, our local governments.
Yeah, unfunded mandates, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's huge. So I think I had a bill several years ago to actually mandate that the state paid at least half of the indigent defense costs. And it was a really large number, but that would have meant a huge infusion into the county, you know, where they could then it give them a little respite in their budgets to be able to do other things. So I just think it continues to be a huge issue. I look at where are property taxpayers protected? How do we protect the property taxpayer from being the one burdened because you have a house or you have a business? Paying that entire piece. And frankly, if you're a landlord and you own your property, those tax increases are going to be, you know, are going to lead to increased, you know, rental rates and things like that. So I just think we really need to just have what does our state budget need to do? What does it need to fund? What are the true priorities? And it's like you and I and every business does with their own finances, right? What can we do? What should we do? What can we do? Or what would we like to do? And a lot of times those numbers look very different. The state of Washington should be no different.
Here's a tax that really affects two different issues. A new 11% tax on sales of firearms and ammunition. There seems to be, maybe not an assault, but certainly, well, you might call it an assault on 2A, and Second
100%.
Amendment.
100%. It's an assault on the Second Amendment. Making it more expensive to purchase a firearm and purchase, ammunition, and then there's other bills that would limit how much ammunition you could have. 100% that is a limit on our Second Amendment rights.
Talking with Senator Shelley Short on Live from Olympia on Okanagan County Radio and Okanagan Country Radio, I should say. And if you have a question, you could call us 509-826-0100 or email me directly, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Last year was kind of dubbed the year of housing, but I said on a podcast this week, it's really the time of housing now. It's not just a one-year thing. Housing is a huge issue. It's a huge issue not just in urban areas where it certainly is something that's talked about a lot, but also in rural areas like the 7th District. What's going on with housing this session, and are there things that can help the situation out in rural areas like yours?
Well, that I wish there were. There are a number of bills, you know, designed to increase flexibility at the local level. Stay tuned whether or not any of those bills are going to gain traction. But look, the Growth Management Act, was something that was put into place back in the early 90s and was really a way for local governments to think about think about where they wanted to grow, how they wanted to grow, protect critical areas, all those kinds of things. Those are all important things, right? But the problem is it's become so rigid anymore. If there is a person or a group that does not like how a county is doing their work, they can do endless appeals on that. Ferry County knows that all too well. Ponderay County's been there. And Stevens has really too. So what GMA, the Growth Management Act, has become is much, much more restrictive, and it's really allowed outside voices to drown out local planning. And so it's had the opposite effect. It's government controlling the outcome instead of having flexibility at the local level. Look, I support the need to protect our critical areas, our agricultural lands, all of those things. I don't have a problem with that. But the local governments still need flexibility. This was supposed to just be a planning document. And what it is it's now a regulatory document. So certainly limiting the amount of land that can be put into growth for housing and just growth of your communities, it's been a huge, huge issue and has really prevented, I think, very, very logical and good, you know, growth in our towns and cities and counties. So huge issue. There are other things. I mean, obviously, you look at infrastructure, whether that's parking or your roads or your sewer water, that kind of thing, obviously is a big issue, too. And I just I wish there were greater flexibility. I think those are the keys. I know builders want to build, and people need housing, and our businesses need people to, you know, they need to hire, you know, more people to make their businesses continue to flourish. It's just unfortunate right now, and I don't have a sense at this time what's going to be successful and what's not.
I mean, it seems like this is an issue that is impacting people statewide. I mean, it's an urban issue. It's a rural issue. It's, you know, you would think this would be an area you could find some bipartisan support and work together on.
Well, and to be clear, there has been some of that, but it's not been when you're part of a group like FutureWise who has the complete ear of folks on the Democratic side of the aisle, it just emboldens them to be kind of the arbiter of what our development looks like. And look, I've met with FutureWise. They've supported some of the bills I've done in the past. I've been grateful for that. But they've kind of taken, all of a sudden, it went from doing better things that give creative flexibility, and now it's just kind of a line in the sand again, where they just... It's almost like they're losing their power, if you will. And so what I've seen is they've gone back to just being no. And it really limits what we're able to do in a bipartisan manner.
I mean, it just seems like there are some groups that just don't want any kind of growth at all. But that's not real. People come here to, they keep on coming to the state, right? You know,
they do.
And plus, you know, young people, you want them to be able to stay here in the state. So if they don't have affordable housing, they're not going to be able to do that.
Well, and, you know, the cities, the growth is going to look different and things than it does in our rural communities. But I think, so it's an impact on both. And it's been a frustrating thing both for, you know, urban cities and our rural counties and cities. So it's just, it looks different, and they still continue to have, these groups have a heavy hand on what that looks like. And it's really unfortunate.
I know we've talked about this a lot, but I just wanted to touch on it one more time, just because it's such a huge issue here in Olympia and in the 7th District, really everywhere, is this parental rights situation that continues to move forward in the legislature. This bill can undoing some of the protections for parents' rights that were in the initiative that passed last year. Talk about where that is in, you know, what you're seeing here in Olympia as far as that issue.
I think we've been talking about it a lot, this, you know, regardless of the issue, it's the majority having, there's not the balance, there's not the checks and balances and the balance that comes with just similar numbers, right, mm-hmm. in the legislature. And I think this issue has been at the top of that. It has been the one that has engendered the most discussion and debate and concern from parents. Ironically, and not in a good way, it's really eroding the community support for public education, and which is already having a detrimental, you know, impact. They've wanted them to be more about, you know, social learning than you know, making individuals, you know, the growth of our students, you know, able to be, you know, adults and have careers and things like that and go on to further education. And it's really sad. So the parental rights bill that came off the floor did reinstitute, you know, that immediate notification for parents, with the exception of the healthcare records. But the House could undo that. Like, it's not there permanently. They could absolutely remove that language and then put it back to what it was originally, which is, oh, well, when we get around to it, you know, we think we'll notify parents when their kids have had something happen, you know, on the school grounds or in school. And so while I'm glad that those amendments were accepted, on the other hand, the House is poised to undo them, and it's now in the House, and we'll see what they do with it, whether they keep it or not. But it's not the right of government to come in and decide how to parent your children, and that's really what's going on. And it's so not right, and it puts our education systems under fire. I think it's a reason that that, you know, there's an exodus of students. There are increases in charter schools. There's increases in homeschooling. Frankly, if I had kids that were young in school age, I would not have them in the public school system. And my kids received a wonderful public education. But if it were today, it is not the right of the state government to decide how to parent my children.
Well, you're going to be voting a lot of bills, you know, here over the next couple of weeks. It's that time finally. So the way it works is after bills are done being heard in committee, and they're pretty much done, and by the end of the week, all the bills will be done in committee, even the bills that have to do with the budget. It's time to go to the Senate floor and vote on those bills and see which ones head off to the House. And the House is doing the same thing. And then when the House bills that pass will come over to the Senate, the Senate bills that pass will go over to the House, and the process starts anew.
It does. It does. This will be a time here. This week we'll be on the floor and in caucus several days this week while the budget committees do their work. And then we're on the floor full time for about 10 days. And I track a lot of the bills in my position as floor leader, Senate Republican floor leader. And so I'm looking at, you know, there are some bills I'm not wild about, and then there are some I'm really not wild about. And so we will be focusing on those bills to see if we can change them or just get rid of them, and stay tuned on that.
Yeah, we'll have an update for you next week, and listen to Senator Short's, all of her different programs that she's on, and check out her website as well. I really encourage you to do that. A lot of good information there. Live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short. Usually we have Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country. They'll be back with us soon. And I'm Tracy Ellis. We thank you so much for listening to Live from Olympia.
Thank you so much.